All right. Good afternoon and welcome to the Filson Historical Society. I'm Mark Wetherington, Director, and I want to thank you for joining us for our Spring Institute. A Nation of Immigrants, How the Introduction of Different Cultures Changed American Society from 1820 to the Present. This is our first day. We have already had a wonderful lunch together, Turkish-American Friendship Association on Congress Boulevard, and thank Peggy and Maria and Fahid. Yes, thank you. It was delicious. We enjoyed it. We appreciate your hospitality very much. Today, the first presentation here, the Filson, is going to be an oral history presentation, and that's going to be given by Peggy Cummins. I'll introduce in just a minute. The title is Louisville's New Immigration. Those of you who had lunch heard Peggy give us some background, and Maria, on the Turkish-American community here in Louisville. It's appropriate that we meet here at the Filson. We have some wonderful material in our collection on immigration, a lot of it dealing with European immigration and African-American immigration. But we'll hope to be changing that as we move forward and having a more diverse representation in our collections. Our programs are varied and a really busy programming calendar. Thank you, Judy, and your staff. If you miss a program, you can hear it on the website. You can go on our website, www.filsonhistorical.org. You can see a podcast. If you miss the groundbreaking, you can actually hit a link on the website from the Act City Access Channel, Metro Access. Watch the entire groundbreaking ceremony. So without further ado, I want to introduce Peggy Cummins. She is Associate Professor of History and Political Science at Jefferson Community and Technical College, where she has taught since 1990. She is involved in immigrant communities, especially the Turkish American Community Association. In addition to her oral history work with Louisville's refugee community, she has written plays based on her interviews, which were produced by a local theater group and presented at schools and other venues. And I'm standing up here with the tape recorder and a number of cassettes out. So, Peggy, I know that if there's a problem, you can turn to Scott to solve that, because I won't be the one that can give you much help, I'm afraid. So at this time, please come to the podium, Peggy. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Filson for this wonderful, really, conference on immigration, and also including the later immigration in the conference. But also, I'd like to say, as a resident of Old Louisville, we welcome the expanded Filson as a really endeared part of our neighborhood. So we're really happy about the expansion and how well it fits into the neighborhood. So all of us in Old Louisville are very happy about that. One of the things that about this presentation is that oral history, sometimes if you want to do it, you have to do it when it's timely. And sometimes when it's timely for the project itself, it's not really timely for you. So I happen to have classes of immigrants at JCTC, excuse me, and I was teaching them history, and I looked out one day and I thought, I've got Jews from the former Soviet Union here that are in their 70s. And this was 1998, 1999, I'm thinking. And I'm teaching them history. And increasingly, I thought, you know, I have to do something to get these stories, because if I wait to maybe do this as a retirement project or whatever, these voices are not going to be around. And for especially these Jews from the Ukraine, these were Holocaust escape stories, some of them. So these are voices that will, you know, well, actually, several of them are already passed. So I was really, you know, it was a really timely thing that had to be done, even though for me it wasn't really the best time in my career. And so what you're seeing is kind of still a raw project. I really haven't written anything up about it. That's really going to be my retirement project, but this is now archived at the University of Louisville. And when I'm ready to do the writing up or whatever I'm going to do with it, then I'll be able to go to the U of L and it'll be there for me, as it was when I checked some of these over. These are not U of L tapes. These are my duplicates. But I do want to pass some things around while we're playing the tapes. And I want to really go quickly through some numbers because, you know, you can't do any kind of presentation like this without some numbers. And for immigration numbers in Kentucky, I relied on Dr. Round Crouch, who's at the, I think, Kentucky Department for Workforce Development now. And so I'll put some of these numbers up. But first, I want to pass some things around. You can just look them as you wish. The first is an example of a hard copy of a transcript. Now, this is the most costly part of doing oral history, these transcripts. And for my tapes especially, they're very important because one of the real problems is that my tapes are very accented because these are relatively new immigrants. And you could wait maybe 10 years for some of them that were younger, and their English would be better, it would be less accented, and probably easier to understand listening to the audio. But that makes the story go stale, and a lot of times people forget. So having these transcripts is really, really important, but it's not cheap to do. And we've got technology today that does voice recognition where it's not as onerous of a task, but voice recognition of some of these accented voices, really, that's still something that's pretty difficult and really takes a human ear to be able to hear. The other thing is, since I didn't do a lot of scholarly work yet on this project, but I wanted to be able to get to people with the project, especially in an educational way, especially to young people. So I wrote a series of 10-minute plays based on some of the vignettes of my interviews, things that were common that I found in several of the interviews from several countries. One of them was families who got here that in their old country, whether it was Ukraine or whether it was Bosnia or Russia, they only can have one child. Because if you know anything about history, we have a baby boom after World War II, but hardly anybody else does. So you would get these families in from these places and from different parts of the world, and almost the immediate thing they do is have another baby. And the grandmothers or grandfathers of those babies, the thing they have in common is he could be the president. She could be the president. They're so proud that they had this grandchild that could be an American citizen. So one of my first plays was in a waiting room in a hospital while these three different immigrant women were waiting for grandchildren to be born, because that was a real commonality. Another thing I had that was sort of common, not only to the interviews, but to some of the state of affairs in Louisville when the first big waves of immigrants started, and that was, well, the Vietnamese, for example, in the 1980s. And because of Catholic Charities and Kentucky Refugee Ministries, resettlement policies, they would often settle them in areas of the South End where you find those enclaves today. And you did have some understandable NIMBY at first. People said, why are they all in this neighborhood? Why are they here? Why are they there? And I think that's kind of understandable. I think any neighborhood might have felt it because it is, you know, it's Vietnamese are quite different than some of the people that live in the South End, so this represented a real challenge to acceptance. I think most of that happened, but, you know, I found a story of this Vietnamese guy who worked in a parish, one of the Catholic parishes out there, that had a barbecue. And this parish had had this barbecue for years and years and years, and they've all of a sudden got this new sauce for their barbecue that is just outstanding. And they think, it's just some South End family. Well, it turns out it was the Vietnamese guy that had the recipe. So, again, it shows how people really integrate, into these neighborhoods, sometimes in a way that you don't even realize. The other thing about my project is that it predates 9/11. And things do change a lot after 9/11. There's more fear. We begin to get other waves of immigrants. We begin, for example, as a result of the Iraqi war, to get a lot of Iraqi translators. So I don't have those people. If I do a future project, I certainly would like to get them. But this community has been outstanding in their acceptance. There's been very little Islamophobia, as you've seen in some other parts of the country. And people have integrated actually pretty well. So At any rate, I'm going to pass around. This is the when we put the our plays on. This was when it was presented at the Rudyard Kipling. So I'll pass this around. You can look at this. And this is the play, The Secret Sauce. Okay, the one about the Vietnamese soul. You can look at it if you like. And then I've got actually some of the immigration papers of a very good student friend of mine from Haiti by the name of McLean Loomis. And Haiti is a country that oftentimes it's difficult to obtain refugee status. Probably some of you know there are different levels of people that come into this country. Some of them come in with certain kinds of visas. But some countries, oftentimes depending on what the political situation, people get refugee status, which immediately plugs them in, you know, to benefits, to the road to citizenship. And Cubans, for example, they have a very well-established political lobby in this country. There, you've probably heard of the law wet foot, dry foot. If a Cuban gets 1 foot on dry soil, automatically they're in. And not to say that Cuba has not been a very oppressive country, because it is, and it was, and it continues to be, but I'll tell you, some of the people in Haiti were in much more danger. And in fact, this young woman, she's beaten and raped at a police station. And yet, in Port-au-Prince, and yet she still has a hard time getting a justification for asylum. So here are some of her papers she's allowed me to share if you want to pass those around to you. All right, let me get into some of these numbers before we get started. All right, in the mid-1990s, ESL enrollment at JCTC had begun to rapidly increase, Jefferson Community and Technical College, where I teach. I teach history and political science in the social science department, and I went to Ann Eubank, who was our first chair of ESL, and said, you know, is there maybe a possibility I could teach a content area? Because most of the ESL English as a second language enrollment that we have at JCC is refugee. We actually, not only, we have four different levels of classes. We've got a low intermediate, we've got beginner, low intermediate, high intermediate, and then regular ESL, English 101 and 102. We've got reading and conversation and grammar and writing, and actually even, there's some of the ESL teachers here today. Doris actually even teaches a class now for ESL students that are interested in allied health careers, because although people might be well-educated in their own country, they don't really often know about the dynamics of the medical profession in our country, even to the point of, you know, eye contact. What are some of the buzzwords? You know, what does upchuck mean, for example? You know, those kinds of things. Sometimes, you know, you don't get those in a regular ESL grammar class. So there's Doris for you. But anyway, and we have a big ESL, we have a big allied health program, and our ESL students are very interested because that's the track, you know, to quick and sure employment. But anyway, in 1995, I began to teach ESL content area classes. And what I did was I teach government, and all these people were on track to want to take the citizenship route, take the citizenship test. So my class was a natural. But we paired my class with an ESL reading class. So the person who taught reading would teach with me. She would use some of the Federalist Papers, for example, my textbook, a lot of original documents that I don't really have time to deal with with all the material I've got to cover in my class. But because she was doing ESL reading, they were actually getting a better class than the regular students were. I mean, it was just really marvelous. And I always felt when you teach civil liberties, for example, teach people about their rights as an individual, you know, Americans, I'm not saying they don't care about it, but it doesn't mean quite as much to them as people who have been deprived of that. I mean, when you teach somebody about freedom of speech, and I can say, you know, I just disagree with the president. I think this policy is really wrong. And you're telling that to somebody who's from Cuba, and they're saying, if I said that in my country, I'd be in jail if I said it about Castro. So what I'm saying is that when you teach that to people that haven't had those civil liberties, wow. I mean, as a teacher, that is just, that's just a dynamic you can't replace. It's just a really wonderful dynamic. And then I really actually got also into teaching history. History paired with the reading class. And it just was a marvelous pairing. And I was lucky in that those first few semesters, I just had people that were, they were so well educated in their own country, English was the only part of the puzzle that they were missing. I had a class full of Jews from the former Soviet Union that were all older, mostly in their 70s. They would get on the bus, the TARC bus down at Jewish Community Center, ride all the way down to JCC, and take my class. I mean, I couldn't believe it. One of the guys was 89, and his mother had been put in jail by the Tsar. So, I mean, that's the kind of history that you're looking at and thinking, oh, my gosh, you know. By 1998, we've got many ESL class alumni, and that's when I really start to think about doing the project because, of course, I'm not going to do anybody that I'm going to be grading. That would be sort of an ethical violation. One aside before I go any further, though, it's really interesting to teach students from different cultures. And there is nobody dearer to my heart than the Russian-Ukrainian students that I taught. But they were the biggest cheaters I've ever taught in my life. I'm not kidding you. And I'm telling you, when you're like 72 and you're pulling a sheet out from under your shirt, skirt or whatever, I mean, I just... And I really begin to think, why is this going on? And you begin to think, you know, if you, as a Jew from the former Soviet Union, you've lived in a country in which the system has been pretty illegitimate in your head for a long time, plus it's been decade after decade after decade of anti-Semitism. You know, you don't have a lot of faith in the system. And then you try to come over and you go through immigration and all the hoops you got to go through. You know, you think maybe... cheating on a test so you can get an A when you're 76 shouldn't be that big of a deal. But I found that if I let the Russians cheat, then the Vietnamese wanted to cheat too. And so did the Cubans. So we got to say, no cheating allowed. Okay, you just got to take the grades that you get. But anyway, by 1998, I had enough ESL class alumni. I felt like I had a good body of people to draw from to do this. In 1999, I got a sabbatical and a grant from the Kentucky History Association. And in 1999 to 2000, I interviewed 50 former students. Now, word to the wise, never do that many again, because that was way too many. I mean, I was running myself crazy. But I did manage to get 50 former students. The youngest student I had was 17, an Atherton junior that I happened to meet doing some community service at Atherton with their ESL students. And the oldest was that guy who was 89 years old, Isaac Bubas, whose mother basically had been put in jail by the Tsar because she didn't sweep the sidewalk. So that's kind of where the project starts. All right, again, oral history, strike while the iron is hot. Precious memories, don't delay. I mean, I have found that even my own memory of this project, when I talk about it sometimes, I get things wrong. I have to go back to the tapes or back to the transcripts. And this is surely true of some of the immigrants who have been through ghastly experiences and escape, you know, Vietnamese boat people, for example, because sometimes after say 10 years, you begin to know, well, this was your experience, but you've heard somebody else's story so often, all of a sudden that's a chapter in your experience too, but not really. So the deal is to strike while the iron is hot. The other thing about the Vietnamese that was often interesting is that if you got into, and we had many South Vietnamese army families here in Louisville that I interviewed in the 90s, and boy, they felt like if we just fought a few years longer, we could have won that war. So, you know, that was kind of an interesting aside from that. And again, availability. Don't let people get away. I mean, I've got people in my classroom, you know, as soon as they're out, I'm saying, you know, I think you would make a really great interview prospect, and I took the address, and I maintained contact with them because, you know, once the semester's over, a lot of times people disappear. And our immigrant population, you know, it's just like when people moved west around the time of the Homestead Act. People move someplace, and they stay there a year or so, and it doesn't work out, and they move on. And that's kind of how it works, really, in immigration today. A lot of the Cubans, for example, a lot of them ended up in Miami at first. Well, you know what? If you're not from a huge city like Miami, probably that's a big adjustment. So we had a lot of people that would end up in Louisville because they came from a like-sized city, and they might have had families here. But the thing about it is, what I'm trying to say is that you have to catch people while they're here. Don't let them get away. And then again, take advantage of an already established relationship. You know, I was a teacher. I got to know these people. They came to my house. We had parties together. And I'll tell you, whenever I did an interview, half the time I was eating. Because you go in an immigrant's house, it's just like the old country. You get in the door, they're going to want to feed you. And I don't care what time of day it was, if you interviewed a Russian, you had vodka. Okay? So those were pretty well lubricated interviews. And oral history, you know, right now this is in the sort of deposit stage. I mean, it's there for people to use, and I know in Dr. Tracy K. Myers' oral history class at U of L, they've used some of these tapes. But the idea is, when I was doing this project, somebody was like, well, do you have numbers and what are the trends? I don't really have the trends yet. I've just deposited the tapes at this point. And they're going to be there, you know, whenever I retire in a few years or whenever anybody wants to use them. But you start out with oral history just getting it. And that's kind of what this project is at this point. Now, why is this project of interest? Well, I think it is, you need to get knowledge about a changing Louisville. Just like you guys are going to be here tomorrow and find out about 19th century changes when the Irish, you know, basically get into Limerick and the Germans into Germantown and Schnitzelburg. That's certainly interesting. But, I mean, we know today, most of us have lived through these changes in Louisville, and how much more interesting is our city nowadays? I mean, we went from 1980 census tract of being one of the top census tracts in the nation of native-born people, just all native-born. And by 1990, that has totally changed. And so, you know, that really has made a difference. Now, you know, we all see our festivals in the Belvedere, and we see all these wonderful restaurants, but you don't have to get very far in the educational system or into the medical center to see, or doctor's offices. I mean, if you go to a Jewish hospital and, you know, you get your lab work reported, a lot of times it's going to be somebody that's former Soviet Union. You may, some of you remember the Jewish Community Center in the, I believe in the 1980s, had a big sign up in front of it that says, Save Soviet Jewry, because things had gotten so harsh, people wanted to get out. And so, you know, those are the kinds of people, they're deeply embedded into our community now. They're everywhere, and they really have made a difference, and they really are our future, because essentially, as I'm going to show you in a minute, I mean, our native-born population is diminishing, especially if you're talking about non-Hispanic white population. The percentages are going down. I mean, it's these immigrants, especially Hispanics, but also African-Americans to some extent. Those are our young people. Those are our future. So those are the kinds of things that you've got to factor in when you think about Louisville, you know, 20 years out. And the politics, of course, you know, you've got to think about, you know, immigration reform, you know, things like people that were brought here and as young children, you know, people that are living under the radar, you know, as illegals, all those kinds of considerations that are really having a hard time tracking their way through Congress right now. But people on both sides of the aisle, I think, are beginning to wise up, because a lot of these really, really red states, what are they turning? Well, they're already purple, aren't they? They're going to probably be blue, you know, within 20 years. Think about Texas, for example. So this is kind of the, I think, facts really that we need to think about when we're thinking about the future. Again, from 1990 to 2000, non-Hispanic whites declined 2.1%, down from basically going down. In 2000 to 2010, non-Hispanic whites declined 1.4%, down 7,495 from the 1990 census. And again, these are Ron Crouch's figures. 1990 to 2000, African American population's up 5.4%, up 16.5% by the 2010 census. Hispanic population, off the chart really here, okay? I mean, we're really increasing. If you get out into other areas of Kentucky besides the metropolitan areas, it's largely Mexicans and agricultural workers from Central America. Here in the Louisville metro area, a lot of that population is Cuban, and we see a lot of it at JCC. 1990s, half the population growth is foreign-born. 2010, two-thirds foreign-born. So this is where the differences are. National statistics increased 9.7%, 91.9% is minorities, 56% Hispanic. So these are really big, huge, you know, figures. All right, why are people here? Well, obviously, just like in the 19th century with the Irish potato famine or the upheaval in German economics, you know, they're here because of problems in their country of origin. Obviously, Vietnamese from the debacle that was the end of the Vietnam War, the Russian Jews, the Jews from the other parts of the Soviet Union because of really anti-Semitism and really, feeling like that was going to go on and probably get worse. The Bosnians, you know, for the Bosnian Civil War, Cubans, obviously, because of the oppression of Castro. Asylum, seeking a safe place. Now, that's something that you don't necessarily get. And they look at the conditions in your country of origin to make that determination. But if you do get asylum or refugee status, I mean, you're automatically on the track for benefits and, you know, on the track to citizenship. It's, you know, a 6 to 7 year process. Economic opportunity. That's what a lot of people come here for economic opportunity. Certainly you see that in your agricultural workers, in the countries that don't get asylum, but even those that do get asylum status, a lot of it is about really looking to the future and thinking that in their own country, there isn't much of a future. Better education. We've got a lot of people coming to the United States basically to take advantage of our universities, better jobs. And in a way, this is good for the United States, and certainly, just like in any time period, we make it easier for people that come in with resources. I mean, as you'll probably hear tomorrow in the studies of the Germans and the Irish, the Germans are welcomed in the 1840s because they come in with business know-how, farming know-how, and money in their pockets. And they don't stay in those eastern seaboard cities. They come to places like Louisville. The Irish, on the other hand, come over with nothing. You know, young people alone, they don't have any money. They don't have education. They stay in those eastern seaboard cities, and it's harder for them. So when you have people coming over here, for example, like the Bosnians, who already have advanced degrees, know two or three languages, those people are going to assimilate, you know, pretty quickly, and they have done so, as compared to, say, people that might come over with very little education. One of the real problems, for example, out in the state is we get all these agricultural workers who really want to know English, but they're not literate in Spanish. It's very difficult to teach somebody a second language when they really can't read and write in their own language. So that's certainly a challenge. A better life for their children. This is not that different than the 19th century. That generation that immigrates is going to have a hard time. They're probably never going to operate at the level they did in their own country, the maximum level. But they're coming over here to sacrifice and do hard work, and a lot of times menial labor. I mean, you might even have people that were far advanced into a medical career in one country, and they're working on an assembly line here. But it's all about better opportunity for their children. And then keeping the family together. Now, that's one that's really dear to my heart because that's what the older Russians were about. These people were communists. They were, for the most part, they lived under communism all their life. They might have not liked everything, certainly about Khrushchev, certainly not about Stalin, but they were used to it. And, you know, when you are 70, coming to a brand new country and culture, that is a real, real challenge. These people are coming because their grandchildren are here. And it's about keeping those generations together. And, you know, it's real sort of marvel of this sort of, you know, return to the notion of the extended family, where each generation helps the others out, that really, for us, I think, is refreshing to see. So keeping the family together is real important. Any questions so far? Okay. All right, local facilitators. Catholic Charities. Sophie, I don't have the Louisville Free Public Library on here, and I am very sorry because the Louisville Free Public Library, especially Sophie's branch out on Woodlawn, Iroquois, right, is the big one. I mean, everything that refugees need from computer help or help with your taxes, you know, children's books written in their native language, that's all out there. That library is a immigrant-friendly zone, and it's out there in the enclave around 3rd Street, very close to the Americana Center. That makes it a very accessible and very, you know, friendly library to go to. But the three main refugee relocators are Catholic Charities, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, which is associated basically with the Episcopal Church, and the Jewish Family and Vocational Service. And the Jewish Family and Vocational Services especially is in critical work in terms of job placement and moving people into new careers. JCPCS has a huge ESL program. Are any of you all familiar with Newcomer Academy? Newcomer Academy is housed in Shawnee High School. It is the ESL school for people that are just off the plane. And generally they stay there, it's a high school, middle school, for two or three semesters, and then they integrate into Jefferson County's ESL program, which is really, really wonderful and huge program. U of L has a whole part of their education school that makes people ESL certified. So really, JCPS has done a wonderful job. As an aside, Louisville's not alone in Kentucky. Actually, if you look at percentage-wise where more immigrants are, there are more immigrants percentage-wise, for example, in Bowling Green. They have a huge ESL population down there. So again, it's not just Louisville that's been on the front line. My own school, Jefferson Community Technical College, we have our ESL program, but we also work with JCPS for basically adult learners of English that don't quite qualify to get in our program. And then you have various government agencies, certainly, and you have prior relatives and friends that certainly work to help get people here and help them to integrate. And by the way, if any of you all are interested in community service of any kind, there's a lot of work that can be done with Kentucky Refugee Ministries and Catholic Charities and Jewish Family and Vocational Services. For example, oftentimes I'll volunteer for KRM just to go and get an apartment set up for an immigrant. You'll get a list of things, and generally groceries like Kroger and Walmart will give you gift certificates. And so you'll go and you'll get the basic essentials to set their refrigerators up, you know, make sure they got enough blankets in the house and it's done, you know, in a way that, you know, plugs into their ethnicity. And it, you know, takes you maybe an afternoon, but there's a welcoming apartment for somebody that's brand new. You know, maybe somebody that was an interpreter, you know, in the Iraq War and is in horrible danger if they stay in Iraq. And in fact, in December, the University of Louisville opened up a torture clinic out on Southside Drive for people to get help who had actually been tortured. And they're seeing a lot of our Iraqis, and they're also seeing U.S. servicemen. So, again, that's how the community has really adjusted to what we're dealing with in a wonderful way. We've really sort of said all this. The waves of immigration in the 1980s with the Vietnamese, increased immigration from Cuba in the 1980s and 1990s. With the break of the Soviet Union and people's ability to leave, we get increased immigration to the United States, especially Russian Jews. Then in the 1990s, we get the Bosnians come to Louisville. Most of them are Muslim. We get a lot of people from Bosnia that are mixed marriages. People, you know, the three big groups there were Orthodox and Roman Catholic and Muslims. And it was Muslims that were really being, the genocide was taking a place against. But you had, you know, the former Yugoslavia had been a place where those people had lived together for, you know, years and years, decades, you know, as one people. And so they were, their families were intermarried. And the marriages across those religious lines were the ones that were, the families that were most likely to really suffer and even to, you know, to be killed. So that's one of the family, that's one of the groups that really got priority, these mixed marriages, and we have a goodly number of those in Louisville. And then, of course, after my project, you have the discord in Sudan and the Lost Boys. And probably all of you have encountered some of that information or even some of the Lost Boys themselves. We have quite a few, or we had quite a few, we still do, at JCC. Somali and Sudan, we've got a lot of Somalis now. We've got a lot of African immigration. I suspect it won't be too long before we'll be getting Syrian immigration, because you've seen the refugee camps. I think Turkey has 1 million refugees from Syria right now, and some of those people will want to go back to Syria when things hopefully shake out and end, the war ends, but some of them don't have anything to go back to, so I would imagine we'll see Syrian refugees. All right, voices from the old country, USSR. The first people I'm going to play some vignettes from are Dina Semichuk and Alex Sitzerin. It's a husband and wife. Dina is a physician. She's still alive. And she was on duty in a Kiev hospital the night of Chernobyl. For all of these older Ukrainian Jews, Chernobyl is a central occurrence. while we were all singing the praises of Gorbachev, and some of us still are, most Putin's not, of course, but, Ukrainians felt betrayed by Gorbachev. They felt betrayed by their own leadership because they really downplayed what happened in Chernobyl. Chernobyl occurred on April 26th of 1986, and a week later, you've got May Day parades. And, I mean, people are marching outdoors. They're getting it all over their shoes. They feel very betrayed. But Dina, let me see if I can get her in here now. Dina actually was on duty and began to see the first responders come in, and they had horrible radiation sickness. Got the right part.
Labor with your daughter?
No.
No? Sometimes when there's a hard birth, when it's a difficult time, congenital.
Initial.
Yeah,
initial. No, this time. Yeah.
From city, from streets, dirty, tired.
Contaminated. Yeah. Oh, terrible. So are you beginning then to see, after the emergency then, do you begin to see symptoms in other people, like cancers and those sorts of things?
Well, yes.
Leukemias?
Yes, hemia, radiation, treatment, and... But our patient, which were before this event, we evacuated at home because was an order receive пострадавших, suffering from
Chernobyl.
What? Why?
It's a terrible time.
Terrible. Yeah. We washed 3-4 times a day because machines is мери как это счетчик.
Гер, прибор, device.
Device.
Shows that
Geiger counters, those kind of things. Geiger counters. They show contamination.
Very high level radiation. Oh. Very. And when to us came a Japanese scientist with
counter,
Geiger. They write to the institute.
And
he's gone.
Bye-bye.
Were you very afraid during this time, Dina?
Afraid? We did not afraid.
No.
We have no time
to think. Yeah, no time to think.
Because very hard patient there.
Yeah.
And very hard, and many, many.
If you lived in Kiev today, would you be afraid of Chernobyl? Because there sounds like there's still problems there.
Very big problem.
Yeah.
Very big problem since today.
Yes. And I don't know what they're going to do about it. How do you clean up something like that? Yeah. So when you get into the 1990s, when do you begin to think about coming to the United States? Who makes that choice to come to the United
States?
Who makes the decision?
Well, it's very hard decision.
It is not our decision.
When our children came to the United States, we decided...
When did they come? When did your daughter and her husband go to the United States?
When our husband, our...
Son-in-law
was... is Jewish also.
Yes.
And when she was in, I told that he was an officer and he take part in war in Afghanistan. When he returned, in this moment, the Soviet Union was broken. And,
yeah.
And he was
Was he bitter about Afghanistan? How did your son-in-law feel about Afghanistan?
He was sick.
Yeah.
He was sick. Dina with a great difficulty because he has not any documents. He put him in the hospital and he was covered.
Their son started in the Soviet campaign in Afghanistan and he got hepatitis while he was there. And the treatment of the Soviet treatment of their own military was pretty awful. And this guy he lived to come to the United States, but he was never really right in terms of his health. I'm going to play a little bit of an earlier part of a tape of Dina and Alex. And this is about Alex, actually. I hope I can capture it. In Kiev, when the World War II is breaking out in the Soviet Union. And let me see if I can find it on here.
They are from the Ukraine. This interview was supposed to have taken place on Tuesday, May 25th, but because of a mix-up in...
I'm going to advance a little bit. You don't need that stuff.
When you were born, and who were your mom and dad? When I don't get the World War II doesn't start until you're a little bit older child in your very young years when you started school. What was the political situation like in Kiev? Was it pretty stable?
Before the war.
The war, yes.
I don't know. I was a kid, and I don't feel anything. I live in my family was big, and I don't feel anything from no religion. Our family was not religious.
Not
a religious family. I knew that my grandfather and my grandmother. Fulfill some religious.
So they had been maybe more religious.
After the revolution, and they were not religious.
When you go to school, what was your school like when you started school in Kiev?
Yes, I started in school in.
Kiev is a big city.
It's a big city, and I started in school in 1938.
Yeah.
And in school, I did not feel any religious, not religious. When we say about. The atmosphere became more difficult after the World War II.
I see.
Yes.
But your young school years were pretty good.
I don't receive them such food, such toys. But the atmosphere was. I don't feel any.
Pressure.
Or
danger.
I don't feel.
No.
I did not feel. Any pressure and danger.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I was
only child.
Only child.
You were your parents' jewel.
I think that they good not so, but it was difficult.
So go on now, and then, so when World War II starts in for you in Ukraine, about what year is that?
I was 10 years old.
10 years old.
Oh.
And so what is your experience? How do things change for you?
Oh, it is, for me, it is most very strong and very dangerous experience. German armies came near the Kyiv. In Kyiv was a very, very big panic. And my parents was educated people, and they knew about the dangers for Jewish in Europe. And my mom decided to save me in the first, save me. She had a sister, как бы Юра? Half sister who had husband who was a doctor in KGB, no, it is in KGB,
service.
in KGB, and they went away from the
KGB gets out early.
From the city in the
first wave,
and she asked her to take me. And I and the sister agreed, and I was as a son for she said the neighbor, the bosses that I was her son, but after the we were allowed in the train for not passenger train, in the train for the
freight train.
Freight?
Just like cargo?
Cargo train. But after the three or four hours, my mother, sister, with her daughter, went away from this train, and the train left it, and they left it, and I was lost alone.
By yourself?
Yes. And I ride alone till the during the maybe a month, and then
you were by yourself, a 10-year-old boy.
Yes,
for a month.
A month. The trip was a month in the. Ural. It is
into the Urals.
Urals.
Mm-hmm.
And when we
were other adults looking after you?
Adults, yes, but it is the, not my relative.
Not your relatives.
And I was stranger for them because it is they don't know who are you, and they don't, and I don't know who.
There.
Yeah.
Were you very scared?
No. I can't. I was a boy in this.
In a little way, it was like an adventure.
An adventure, and in this, when we came
Anyway, his mother finds him after a month, but I'm sure she didn't think it was an adventure. I'm going to play a little bit out of a Bosnian tape now. This is a guy by the name of Sanjan Sopjak. He was in his early 20s when I had him in class. Very good student. For a while, his father was a piano player at Jack Fry's. But it's about his first days in Louisville. Oops, I got the tape stuck in here. And
I would understand, I'm coming from over there, and you're there, and
you're June 23rd, and we're on take two of Sanjan's interview. He has just come to Kentucky, and he's talking about initial experiences with the immigration process at Catholic Charities and some sort of intrusive, I guess you would say, interviews.
Yeah.
So you had these interviews, and they're checking you out, seeing what your situation was like in your old country, trying to see if you can justifiably be called a refugee, I guess.
Yeah. Probably one of the things. And then, I wanted to go to school, and they said I need to work, because I know language, and it was like, you need to go to work, you don't need to go to school. And from that point, I stopped going over there. I didn't want to have nothing, I was like, it's not a big deal. If you're not going to help me, you're not going to help me.
Yeah.
And I was just, disappointed at one point, saying like, it's not, I would understand, I'm coming from over there, and you're supposed to, come in your way and say, this is it. And I mean, I had people take me to a Social Security office and, get some things done, and, that's probably their job. But that was it, It wasn't like, you're going to come over here and they're going to help you with this, I didn't ask for the clothes, I didn't ask for the furniture.
Yeah.
But they were saying they were supposed to give you a bed and, mattress or something like that, but I never got anything from them, And I would see, another family, not only Bosnian, getting everything, So I know how that works. Does it work?
So it was you're treated unevenly.
It was kind of like, but I wasn't mad or jealous or something, What we had. So it was kind of like...
Well, you were together. That was
the
big thing, too.
That was the big thing, just to be together, so...
Yeah. So that was, now we're in, 1994?
96.
96,
okay. August of 96. All right. That's when I got.
So then what did you do in the first few months? Where did you start to work?
I had to go to Catholic Charities to school every night. I think it was like $160 you would get a month if you go to school.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of through that program.
Did you really need the school?
Well, I didn't need a school, but they sent me to test me, And again, it was kind of like, she put these I understand, but I came there forward like, hello, my name is Sanjan, and they sent me from Catholic Charities, and I'm supposed to take this test, and the lady that was there, she put all these little things and asking me, so do you know what this is, and what is this, how you say this number, and do you know the money here, And then she said, you don't have to go. You can come if you want to, So sometimes my dad will take me, or one of the neighbors used to live here. She would go to school, and, it was
so
like...
So you were going, so you got the money,
like,
yeah.
Okay, I was like, okay, yeah. Let's just go. You'll get the money for the first 2 months. In the 2 months, you need to find yourself a job and start working. And then Catholic Charities, they find me a place to work here in the mall, but to be maintenance, to clean.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, if I could find me something else, knowing the language.
Sure.
And why wouldn't I do this, So I went to every single store, mm-hmm. with application, but nobody ever called me.
Because of your name?
I don't know. Nobody ever called me, I had references from Prague that my boss, who was from Great Britain, wrote and said, that the store I used to work in had an increase of 29% in sales, and that we received the biggest bonus, and, he had 11 stores in Prague with the same merchandise, and we were one of the best ones. And I was just, it was November, and through a friend of my parents, another, her friend is a lawyer here, and I called her on the phone and I said, well, you know, I put these applications, I'm looking for a job and stuff like that. And she said, tell me the store where you want to work. And I said, I put it on at Target. And at that point, there was still Bacon's. And she said, do you want to work in Bacon's? And I said, she said, well, Bacon's is a much nicer place. And I said, well, I put already in Target. I kind of like Target, you know.
Anyway, he ends up in Target. And it's what a reference can do for you. Any questions so far? I don't want to get too, we're getting, I want to have time for questions. Do you want to hear more tapes? I mean, I'd like to play a Cuban tape for you, actually a Vietnamese tape, but I want to go back to, okay, the PowerPoint here from, let's see. Luan Nguyen, actually, it was a student of mine that, very smart young woman, and she ended up going to speed school. And she now lives in the South End. She's married to an American, and she has two children. Her story is interesting, and I don't even know if we need to hear it but on tape, but she was a toddler in a big family. She's like the youngest kid, and she was like 3 years old, like in 1972, when her family, they lived in a small town about 100 miles from Saigon, got caught in crossfire and between the North and South of the Vietnamese Army, because by that time the American ground troops were pretty well out. And so a lot of her, that part of her story, she doesn't remember because it's told her, she's so young. But she does remember that her father got shot, and he lay under the bed for like 3 days. There was no ability to get medical care, and so he basically bled out. And so she had a big change in her life then, because her mother didn't, she had to have a livelihood for this large group of children. But she ended up sending Loan to the United States to live with the oldest sister in the family, who Loan really didn't know, and lived in West Virginia. Can you imagine going from Vietnam to West Virginia? And was married to an American serviceman. Well, Loan's so cute, she was never happy in West Virginia. I don't know if it was the sister thing or if it was West Virginia. But one day she's found out that in Louisville, they had Vietnamese restaurants, Vietnamese grocery stores. So she told her sister, I'm going to Louisville. And by gosh, she came to Louisville by herself and to JCC, transferred to U of L, did very well at speed school. And she friended me on Facebook about a month ago. She has two little children right now. Just a really, really neat young woman. I don't know if any of you have ever been out to St. John Vianney Parish. Mari, you taught out there for a while. And I don't know if they had the statue when you were there or not, but the Vietnamese community in Louisville had the statue commissioned and built in Vietnam, and it's Our Lady of Vietnam. And it's a gorgeous statue. If you ever have a chance to go out there, it's on Southside Drive, right just south of the Americana Center. And the Ave Maria, the Hail Mary, is written in that, and I don't know, several different languages all around the base of the statue. And then, of course, you see the Asian influence with the dragon there. But so just that's just, to me, really something that represents the beauty of that enclave. Also, Value Mart out there is so wonderful. It really does cater to the immigrant population, but that's something that's worth seeing. In terms of Bosnia, I have these two people. I'm not going to play them today, but I will talk a little bit about them. Alberto Martinez is such a neat guy. Sophie, you may know Susan, Alberto's widow, okay? Because Alberto immigrated here. And by gosh, when I got his tape, on his tape, there is a flaw in it that doesn't make it play well. But they've got it at the U of L archives. This was a guy that had a psychology and theater background in Cuba. And in those days, before the Iraq War, Guantanamo was the holding area for Cuban refugees. The Coast Guard would pick them up out of the Caribbean and take them to Guantanamo, and they generally stayed there for weeks for processing. And Alberto actually was there, and what he did was he organized refugees into these theater projects where they could sort of play on what their experience had been in Cuba and sort of use that to process themselves, you know, from one culture to the other, and just through the sort of trauma of, you know, being picked up out of the ocean by the U.S. Coast Guard. He got to the United States, didn't like Miami, came to Louisville pretty early on, and he was working for a Louisville Ladder Company. And I'll tell you, when I interviewed him, he made me the best paella I ever had. He was cooking the whole time we were interviewing. And he married Susan, a librarian at the Iroquois branch, and she was pregnant with twins when I interviewed him. And the next thing I know was a couple years later, and he died of brain cancer. You know, it was so sad, you know, but the first thing I did was to get my tapes duplicated and sent to her so that someday she's able to let those twins hear their father's voice, because he was just a really, really wonderful fellow and had just everything going for him. He was doing very well. His English was really good. He'd done well in school. So that was just really a sadness. Now, Aileen Ramirez is another one that was, she was just a young woman. She had a hard time at JCC, but she worked hard, and she got through the English classes, and I think she went into one of our technical programs. But the two of them, really, it was interesting to hear their story of leaving, because you know, they both went through the experience of getting on a raft at different places in Cuba and sailing out into the Caribbean, you know, under the cover of night. And you always think of them like, oh, they come all the way to Florida. Well, most of these Cubans don't. And, in fact, both of these individuals were just in the water for a couple of hours, because by the time they got out to the international waters, the U.S. Coast Guard was out there patrolling and really dropping stuff down to them and helping them. You know, they would send a boat out and actually get people over to Guantanamo. Now, that didn't mean it was safe, because Alberto, they basically experienced a raft that they could just see off in the distance that capsized, and everybody aboard was killed. Everybody aboard was drowned. But, you know, just the experience of going through Guantanamo, being on the raft, getting to Florida, not really liking Miami. Aileen had actually family already up here in Louisville, so that's one of the reasons that she transferred up here. And she's still in Louisville, and certainly Alberto's children and Susan are still, I guess, does Susan still work at the library? Yeah. So, any questions? Any comments? Well, I guess I can close it out then. As I said, this is just, you know, I'm really happy this Filson has seen fit to celebrate this immigration, because I think it, at least it's my opinion, that it's made Louisville a much more interesting place. Thank you very much.
How is the program for them evolved? What are they doing now that they weren't doing before, and what's it probably going to do in the future that's not doing now?
Well, I think in terms of evolving, in terms of there are different kinds of refugees coming now for different reasons. You know, we're getting people from the Iraq War. I would think we'll get Syrian refugees soon. We're getting people, we've got Afghanis here in Louisville. So we've got a lot more people from the Middle East, and as situations in Africa have become more and more torn up. I mean, that's been some of our latest waves of immigration, you know, that have been from different parts of Africa, Somalia, East Africa, you know, just different places like that. I do think there is a friendlier attitude about immigration, at least on the local level. I don't think people feel threatened by it as they did, you know, when those first changes came about. I think a lot of it's because, you know, this has been, even in the hard times, people have been able to get job placement, get their kids into good schools, and I think people have done pretty well here. I speak from my experience, at least at JCC, but, you know, and I do think you're seeing, you know, new attitudes on both sides of the political spectrum with regard to, you know, the future of immigration. Yeah.
Just picking up on what you just said, that in Louisville we have an easier feeling assimilating these new refugees. Why is it we can't have that easy feeling for the Hispanics who are coming here? They're hard-working.
Well, I will tell you, if you get out into rural Kentucky and you talk to farmers, our farmers in rural Kentucky are happy with their Hispanic farmers. I mean, they know that that is vital to Kentucky agriculture. They're looking for ways to have people here legally, to have them. And, for example, you go out to Shelbyville. I mean, there's a huge ESL population in the Shelby County High School. And, you know, that population, Some of them in the next generation, they're moving out of farm work. They've got restaurants. They've got businesses. So you see that same kind of evolution you've seen historically in every immigrant group. So, you know, you get a lot of, I think, information on the macro level that sometimes noise. But if you go on the micro level and start talking to people, you really see a lot more acceptance in the rural areas because, again, they are vital to Kentucky. They're vital to agriculture just about every place. Any other comments? Yeah.
Different social service agencies that you mentioned earlier, do they have specific programs for people from Mexico and Central America?
Well, they do, but in Louisville, that's not our big number. You know, if you go out to the more rural areas, yes, there's programs out there. Some of them are run through Catholic Charities, but Louisville doesn't get that big influx of agricultural workers like they do out there. So, yeah, we do have Mexicans coming to Louisville, but not in the big numbers that we have in some of the other refugee populations. And as a result, our problems are different. I mean, out in the rural areas, education, especially for that older generation, is difficult because they're not literate in their own language. The boy that generation come along afterwards that's been through the Shelby County Schools, they got a great ESL program out there, and they do wonderful things. And those kids JCC, for example, has a Shelbyville campus. And we've got a lot of those kids in school now. So, you know, it's a little different situation when you're talking about farm workers out there. And some of those people don't stay all the time. Some of them go back home. But I can think of one farmer in particular, the farmer that donated our land at JCC for the Shelbyville campus. I mean, every year he goes to Mexico to visit where his workers live. I mean, they have a close, it's not just working, it's a friendship, really. And that's what you get because he goes, they bring me ideas, I give them ideas. And so, again, on the micro level, when you talk about individuals, I see a lot of acceptance, actually. And out in the rural areas, probably it's different agencies than here because our needs are somewhat different. Yeah?
Are the people migrating or coming here to Louisville area, are they primarily refugees? And if they are primarily the refugees, is it the work of the government, the state government, having some sort of program?
Well,
or is it the individual churches kind of...
Both, but especially Catholic Charities is the huge resettlement agency, and that actually, they are really a government agency of sort. You know, it's Catholic Charities, but they deal sort of as the direct conduit to resettle people, and a lot of times they do work through churches, but a lot of the people that we get a lot of people that are not refugees. I mean, the Turkish community, for example, is not refugee, but we get a lot of people that are. And, you know, Louisville has been very good, I mean, and Catholic Charities in particular. Kentucky Refugee Ministries, too, but they're smaller. They have done a really good job of relocating people and really getting them integrated into the community educationally, economically. And it's amazing how Louisville families and churches have just opened their arms and adopted families and made sure their transition, you know. And also the people from their ethnic communities that were here earlier do a really good job because... as an Asian, you know the importance of the family. And, I mean, the family is everybody, really, that you know, your cousins and aunts and uncles, they come here, and you're going to see that they, you know, have a leg up. So we have a lot of that going on, too. Yeah?
One of your slides, you flipped it past, but it said, voice of the old country, Egypt. I wonder who that
is. Well, I didn't get to that. I don't want to bore you too long with tapes. I was interested in the Egyptian one. Because they say a lot on that tape about how they're cut off their families. And that's a big change now because of Skype, okay? Because as a lot of people can tell you, you know, if you can talk to your mother just about any day you want to, and it's just, well, it's not free, but it's almost free, that is a huge difference. Whereas back in 1999, you know, people were just really beginning to integrate email into their lives. But now you've got Skype, and so, you know, these people that felt so cut off, you know, that doesn't necessarily, I mean, there's still a time difference. Certainly that's a problem. But you can still talk to your family, like Miraj. You know, he talks to his family, his Turkish family, you know, very frequently, and it makes you feel just a little bit less isolated from them. So that's one thing that's really, really changed, and that's something that the library and Catholic Charities has facilitated some refugees that maybe wouldn't have had computer access early on. They could go to the library or to the Americana Center and basically, you know, have access to whatever they want to do in terms of email. That's just another way that there was an outreach. So, you know, maintaining those connections back home just make it just a little less traumatic.
Anything else? Yeah.
Yeah, and before the government got involved, let's say maybe at the turn of the last century, mm-hmm. 1890s, 1900, who filled that that gap for resettlement? Were those early versions of neighborhood and settlement houses, like maybe Cabbage Patch, or and families? Or?
Absolutely, I think there were. And, you know, before, well, really, even up to 1923, the government was involved, but not in a good way. I mean, you get the National Origins Act in 1923 where they quotas on people. And, I mean, for example, some of those quotas that they put on people, like people from Central Europe might have a low quota. And if so many people got in, the door was closed. Well, that really condemned people to the gas chamber a lot of times because they wouldn't ease those quotas. But, yes, I mean, and a lot of it depended on resources. If you had family over here, probably some of you have been through Ellis Island. You know, you didn't go to Ellis Island if you had resources. You went to Ellis Island, basically, if you were poor and working class. Now, most people made it through, but if you were wealthy, you didn't have to go there. But, you know, a lot of times what it took was, you know, sponsorship. You had to have somebody over here that would sponsor you. There's a really good film, basically, an American Experience with PBS, where these three Germans get out, these kids and their family, and they're working like crazy to be able to get their parents over. But by the time they get their resources together to get them over, you know, the quota numbers are basically too, inflated. They can't get their parents out, and their parents end up going to a concentration camp and dying. So, you know, we come a long way since those times, and I think there are a lot of things that, you know, especially if you think about the aftermath of World War II and what we knew happened, and maybe we could have done more to rescue people. I think those have made a change too. So now the government, I think the government, I won't say is working for us, for immigration all the time, but it's working, I think, to be fair about it. And I think that's where you're seeing the laws, you know, really begin to go in the right direction. And even if it's for political good, I mean, both sides of the aisle, as I said, you know, it's to their political benefit to be paying attention to these numbers. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
The National War,
The Origins Act?
I believe what made it worse is they based their information on the census of 1890.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what it also was based on were people that were already here and would have a say. For example, the National Origins Act, the door is wide open to Irish because there's a gob of Irish Americans by that time. It's a huge lobby. But it's not very open to Polish people, you know. And that rigid quota on Polish people is going to sentence people to Auschwitz, you know, 15 years later. And, you have to really put yourself back in the 30s and realize the isolationism that was going on in this country and also the anti-Semitism. That really does have an effect on the fact that we in Britain didn't do as much as we could have to ameliorate the numbers of the Holocaust. And that's something that we're basically playing out politically even today, I think. Any other comments? Well, good. Thank you very much.
There you go. Great job. Thank you. And thank you for joining us for this session. I know some of you are signed up for...